Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, two analysts of the international scene. First, former UN Iraq weapons inspector, United States Marine Corps Colonel Scott Ritter, now retired. He takes us through what's been going on since the invasion of Iraq in the Middle East. Also, Andrei Vilcek is a Russian filmmaker, poet, journalist and philosopher, an expert on the Ukraine-Russian relations. Therefore, you're not likely to hear him on the BBC. He talks about the recent incident in the Sea of Azov, where the Russian Navy stopped three Ukrainian vessels, and he explains exactly why. It turns out it's got quite a lot to do with the forthcoming presidential elections in Ukraine. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. If you have a story or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
Well, my name's Scott Ritter. In 1998, I was a chief weapons inspector with the United Nations Special Commission on Iraq, charged by the Security Council of the United Nations under various Security Council resolutions to oversee the disarmament of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction capability. I resigned my position in August of 1998, protesting interference by United States, a lack of will on the part of the Security Council, and a failure to fully comply with its obligation to disarm. My entire position was revolved around the issue of a credible inspection process. My responsibilities were numerous. I was brought into the United Nations Special Commission back in 1991 for the purpose of helping set up an independent intelligence capability that could receive and organize and analyze information provided by member states regarding Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs. Iraq was obligated under the original Security Council Resolution 687 to provide a complete declaration of the totality of its holdings. But one of the problems that we encountered early on was that Iraq had not told the truth, that they had withheld a significant amount of information about their programs, to include totally denying having a nuclear weapons program, total denial of having a biological weapons program, under declaring both their ballistic missile capabilities and their chemical weapons capabilities. And so this intelligence capability was essential to the success of the inspection operation, because you can't inspect into a vacuum. You need to know what you're looking for, where it should be, what it should look like, what exactly the inspectors are going to do on the ground. So that was my job. It grew in scope and scale once inspection teams started coming back from Iraq, because the inspection process, we would receive this information from supporting nations, then we would go into Iraq and we would determine whether it was accurate or inaccurate. And what happened is the inspectors became more knowledgeable about what was going on in Iraq than the intelligence services that were supporting us. And I, as the intelligence, is the person running the intelligence for the Special Commission, took on an even more prominent role as an inspector, helping plan and lead the inspection teams into Iraq. And this is a job that I continued from 1991 until my resignation in 1998. One of my principal jobs in 1998 was going after what we called the concealment mechanism. That is the means by which Iraq was withholding and hiding information and material from the Special Commission. We knew that Iraq was doing this back in 1991, and Iraq denied this, which led us to be in a situation where, in order to show that Iraq was being compliant, we had to get them to admit that they had a concealment mechanism, to declare what the concealment mechanism looked like, and to demonstrate to us that this mechanism had been dismantled.
because only then could we trust the data that we were getting out of Iraq. And by 1998, the data was actually pretty good. We were able to confirm that Iraq had destroyed or dismantled or accounted for between 95 to 98% of its arsenal. The problem is, 2 to 5% of weapons of mass destruction capability is still a weapons of mass destruction capability. And we weren't sure whether this was just an accounting problem, that the stuff had been blown up and unable to be found, or if Iraq was still hiding it from us. And so I was carrying out very aggressive inspections inside Iraq to uncover this concealment mechanism capability. And it was these aggressive inspections that were blocked by the United States and indeed the United Kingdom and hampered by the Secretary General of the United Nations out of concern that these confrontations were putting the United Nations in a politically sensitive, precarious situation. So from my perspective, it looked as if people were selling out on the responsibility of the Special Commission to complete its tasks under Security Council resolution and empowering Iraq to be even more non-compliant. We were charged with disarming Iraq, and I could not stand before anybody and say that I could confirm that Iraq had been fully disarmed, until which time Iraq had complied. So I resigned, and I brought this to the attention of the United States Congress in hopes that the administration of President Bill Clinton would reverse its policy of obstructing inspections and allow weapons inspectors back to work to complete the important tasks that they had been given.
I mean, looking back on it now, it does seem that the bad guys were not the Iraqis at all, that the bad guys were the Brits and the Americans. There's been absolute devastation in that part of the world, and there were no weapons of mass destruction. There was certainly none that were threatening Britain, America, or Europe, or even some of the neighboring states like Israel.
I mean, we know that today for certainty, and it's something that many observers could have speculated about in 1998. But you're missing the point. The point is that the international community had agreed upon a process of disarmament that required the Iraqi government to be fully transparent regarding every aspect of its weapons of mass destruction programs. Iraq was not fully transparent. This put the inspectors in a position where we had to dig very deep, so deep, in fact, that we were gaining access to aspects of Iraq's security that the Iraqis found to be very sensitive. And unfortunately, nations like the United States, who claimed to be supporting the inspection process for the purpose of furthering disarmament, were actually using the inspection process to gather this sensitive information so that they could undermine the security of the Iraqi regime and overthrow the presidency of Saddam Hussein.
The police call this a phishing operation.
Well, it's not a phishing operation purely because, again, the Iraqis were obligated to provide a full declaration. They did not, not until the very end. Iraq continued to quibble on the details, especially when it came to the process of unilateral destruction that took place in the summer of 1991. This is a very important thing that maybe not too many people are aware of. Because of the aggressive stance taken by the inspectors early on, the Iraqis came to the conclusion that they would not be able to hide these weapons that they retained. And we have to start with that, an understanding. The Iraqis cheated from day one. When people say there are no weapons of mass destruction in 2003 when the invasion took place, it's not because there were never weapons of mass destruction. There were weapons of mass destruction, considerable quantities of them, and massive programs dedicated to their production, which the Iraqis refused to declare and turn over to the weapons inspectors. In the summer of 1991, under pressure from these inspectors, the Iraqis decided that they would go ahead and unilaterally destroy this capability. Now, the right thing to do would have been to come to the United Nations and say, hey, we lied to you in May when we gave you the initial declaration. Here's the truth. But the Iraqis wanted to have sanctions lifted, economic sanctions that were initially put in place in August of 1990 when Iraq invaded Kuwait, but then continued in April of 1991, linked to Iraq's disarmament obligation. Iraq wanted these sanctions lifted. They initially tried to get them lifted by lying to us and keeping weapons of mass destruction. Now they made a decision to not declare their weapons of mass destruction capability, but rather destroy this capability unilaterally and then act as if nothing had transpired. The problem is we're good inspectors, and we were able to uncover the fact that there was a significant quantity of weapons of mass destruction capability unaccounted for. And we confronted the Iraqis with this in 1992, and they were forced to admit that, yes, we're right. Our accounting was correct. They had lied to us yet again, and they had destroyed this material in the summer of 1991. So now we begin a forensic investigation into what was destroyed, which means we have to go to the destruction pit, dig up the dirt, pull out the bodies, so to speak, and count them to see if they add up. And this was a process that took many years. The other problem with this is that there was some material that we could not account for. So then we had to ask the question, who hid the weapons? Who hid the weapons from the inspectors? And we knew the answer to that. It was Saddam Hussein's personal security forces. But the Iraqis would not admit this. So they lied about the process of concealment from the inspectors, which led us to believe that if they're going to lie about that, the reason why they're lying is that they're still concealing weapons. And so the situation in August of 1998 when I resigned was not as crystal clear as a lot of people would like to believe. The Iraqis had lied to the Special Commission repeatedly, and there was concern that they could continue to be hiding not massive quantities of weapons of mass destruction capability, but some capability. And remember, the Security Council resolutions didn't say disarm Iraq to 95%. They said disarm Iraq to 100%. And as a weapons inspector, it's not my purview to accept anything other than that which is set forth under the law.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, Scott, what's happened since is that it now looks as if that you were part of an operation really to set up the Iraqis. Because what's happened now since then is so. I mean, what do you think of, you know, the mission you were given with hindsight? It's always very easy to see what might have been or what might have happened. What do you make now of the situation and how it looks as if you and others were used in order to attempt to build a case in the international press and at the United Nations for some sort of intervention, which actually it looks now as if was pre-planned, maybe even decades before?
Well, you know, I'm not some naive innocent. Most of the people who worked with me in the Special Commission were not naive. We knew from day one that the United States had no intention of allowing economic sanctions to be lifted regardless of Iraq's disarmament status. How did we know this? Because that was the stated policy objective of the United States. They made it known that as early as 1991 that sanctions would never be lifted until which time Saddam Hussein was removed from power. We were continuously confronted with this statement by senior Iraqi officials. Tariq Aziz, the deputy prime minister, would always tell us, why should we cooperate with you? Because even if we do cooperate, sanctions won't be lifted. We told him what we told everybody. That's not our business. That's a political question for the Security Council. Inspectors do not get involved in that business. Inspectors carry out the requirements set forth by Security Council resolution. And that's what I did, and that's what the others did. We weren't used by anybody. We executed our mission. The problem was that there was a political decision made in Washington, D.C. as early as 1991 that it didn't matter what we did. They weren't going to go forward with that. Our only hope was that we could finish our job, disarm Iraq, go to the Security Council and confront the Security Council with, you know, the finality of the task. And then the United States would have to deal with the political consequences of that. We were opposed continuously by the United States. Again, I told you they stopped letting us do the inspections. Why? They stopped us because they did not want a finding that could support the Iraqi contention that they were disarmed. That's the last thing the United States wanted. They didn't want Iraq to be found to be in compliance. They wanted to maintain the notion that Iraq was not in compliance, therefore sanctions could be continued until which time the United States could develop the means to overthrow Saddam Hussein. Now, the other thing that I'll take umbrage with is the notion that this was a plan decades in the making. I'll tell you, somebody who is as close to the inside as you're going to get, there was no master plan taking place. We're talking about three successive presidential administrations, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and then George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, then George W. Bush. There is no continuity between the three of them. There was chaos. There was incompetence. And there was, a lot of floundering going on. In the first Bush administration, they thought that Saddam would be gone within 6 months. That's why they wanted to maintain economic sanctions. When Saddam continued to survive, they did not have a plan in place to deal with his continued survival as the president of Iraq. Under Bill Clinton, the initial premise of the Clinton administration was to seek to get the sanctions lifted and bring Iraq back into the family of nations. They failed on this. One of the big scams that's been run is the notion that Iraq tried to assassinate President George H.W. Bush when he visited Kuwait in April of 1993 to celebrate the 1993 to celebrate the Gulf War victory. But there was no assassination attempt. It's a manufactured thing by the Kuwaiti government, bought into by the United States for the sole purpose of compelling the Clinton administration to back away from normalizing relations with Iraq.
So I mean, just a minute, Scott. What right do Britain and America have to remove Saddam Hussein? What right did we have? I mean, because the Security Council ultimately didn't even vote for us. So it's almost like it's the pot calling the kettle black here, isn't it? I mean, we're complaining about them not complying with international law, and then we, both sides of the Atlantic, we invade Iraq without complying with international law.
Again, I'm not going to defend a policy of regime change, and I will say this: even though I'm an American and I was a commissioned officer in the Marine Corps, while I was with the United Nations, I was a United Nations civil servant carrying out the resolutions passed by the Security Council of the United Nations. So don't conflate the work that I and other inspectors were doing with the policies of the United States. We didn't represent the United States. We didn't represent the United Kingdom. At least we weren't supposed to. We worked for the United Nations. And that put us in a very difficult situation because, as you rightly pointed out, the policy objectives of the United States and the United Kingdom and others did not comport with their claimed support of the United Nations Security Council resolutions that they voted in favor of.
Do you think we can learn anything from what happened in Iraq to make sure these sorts of things don't happen again? Because there's been so much destruction in that part of the world. We've heard the war on terror in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan, I believe, has cost at least 500,000 innocent lives.
Or more. I don't mean to laugh and minimize it, but the fact of the matter is, the greatest threat to international peace and security is the American-led overreaction to the events of 9/11. I mean, we've basically triggered instability in the Middle East and in Central Asia that has manifested itself in not in the elimination of terror, but the growth of terror. Al-Qaeda-inspired terrorist cells are global now. And the United States doesn't have a plan in place to successfully counter them. We're spending $700 billion a year on a defense program that can't defeat tens of thousands of lightly armed insurgents around the world. It's insane. But the lesson to be learned from this is the Security Council. I mean, the key here is the Security Council of the United Nations. It's a failed institution. It's an institution that has been and continues to be susceptible to corruption by its members, especially the five permanent members of the Security Council. What happened in 1991 with Iraq wasn't that the Security Council agreed on on the disarmament of Iraq. It's that the United States compelled the Security Council to vote in favor of a resolution it drafted to sustain its own national policy. This wasn't about the world doing the right thing in Iraq. This was about the United States using the United Nations to achieve its policy goals. And this situation exists today, whether it's Russia in Syria or the United States defending Israel. The Security Council is a fundamentally flawed, broken institution. And if we want to have a truly international approach to collective security concerns, we're going to need to reform the Security Council and basically dismantle the post-World War II order that the Security Council preserves and seek to empower, a different panel of nations that probably will be inclusive of the United States, Russia, France, Germany, Russia, France, the UK, China, but will include nations like Germany, will include India, will include Brazil, will include, maybe third world collectives.
But that may not be so far from reality, because there's been talk recently about potentially because of Brexit, removing Britain, because Britain is not the power that it used to be in the world, from the Security Council. And also there's been sounds about maybe removing Russia from the UN Security Council because of some of their behaviour. What do you make of those two proposals?
Well, if you're going to remove Russia, you got to remove the United States. And if you're going to remove the United States, you got to remove the United Kingdom. If you're going to remove the United Kingdom, you got to remove China. No, I don't think behavior should be what decides. I think it should be, the role that a nation plays in the international order. Because what we're talking about is a collective of nations sitting on a security council. That is a council that oversees security. If you remove Russia from the equation, how do you contain Russia then? Are you talking about the potential of the world going to war against Russia, inviting thermonuclear holocaust? That's about as absurd as it gets. So, no, that's stupidity personified, talking about removing these nations from the Security Council. Maybe Great Britain, because it's no longer the power that it once was, but Great Britain's voice should be heard perhaps through a European Union collective, representation of that nature, except with Brexit, it doesn't want to be part of that community anymore. So,
well, that's if Brexit happens. I mean, there's soundings literally the last few days saying it might not. But anyway, I wonder, Scott, what you make of the potential conflict which seems to be brewing between Israel and Iran. The Iranians are getting upset. Particularly after Benjamin Netanyahu was stood at Dimona nuclear plant recently threatening war against Iran. And obviously that's a nuclear threat he's making.
Well, I mean, I'm not one who's bought into the notion of Iranian malign activities. Iran is a regional power, a regional superpower. And as such, Iran has the same right to be concerned about what's transpiring in the region as any other nation. And if you take a look at what Iran's doing, what they're accused of doing, they're guilty of doing, one is supporting the legitimate government of Syria against an illegitimate effort to remove it. I don't condemn Iran for being in Syria. They're seeking to stabilize a long-term ally. Unlike the United States president in Syria, Iran's been invited by the Syrian government. You take a look at what Iran's been accused of doing in Iraq. It was the United States who invaded Iraq and overthrew Saddam Hussein and created a vacuum, a power vacuum. Iran, a neighbor of Iraq who fought an eight-year war, had every right to step in and seek to stabilize that situation in a manner which was favorable to it. We did the same thing in Afghanistan. We toppled the Taliban government, creating a vacuum, and Iran is now actively involved in Afghanistan, seeking to create a stable situation that is favorable to its interests. In Yemen, in the support of the Houthi, it's not Iran that started this war. It's Saudi Arabia that started this war. Iran's seeking stability. So when I look at Iran's activities in the region, I don't see them as malign. I see them as stabilizing. I see them as a necessary reaction to irresponsible policies undertaken by the United States, Saudi Arabia, and even Israel. So I'll start off on that. Israel doesn't have a leg to stand on in terms of a justified position. That's never stopped Israel in the past from doing things that that people disagree with. But when it comes to Israel making statements about Iran, I think Israel understands a couple of realities. One, they're not as good as they think they are. And what I mean by that is one just simply has to take a look at the 2006 war with Hezbollah and the fact that the Israelis did not wipe Hezbollah off the face of the map as they had promised. Hezbollah didn't win that war in terms of decisively defeating the Israelis. They won the war by surviving. You know, we were told that the Israeli Air Force would annihilate Hezbollah. It did not. We were told that the vaunted Israeli Defense Force on the ground would close with and destroy Hezbollah. It did not. Hezbollah stood up and fought and, in many cases, prevailed against the Israelis. This is the reality. They're not as good as they think they are. You know who's good now? The Syrians are pretty good. Hezbollah is very good. The Iranians are extremely good. They've all learned the art of war thanks to the American-led intervention in Iraq in 2003 and the instability that's been engendered since then. But the Iranians aren't suicidal. They're not seeking a confrontation with Israel because they understand that a decisive confrontation with Israel would result in some detrimental things happening to their infrastructure and their economy. Iran is going to let Israel hang itself, and that's what's happening right now. Netanyahu may stand at Dimona and make a speech, but what's the reality? He's a prime minister under investigation for corruption. His political coalition is falling apart. There may be a need for elections that he will not prevail in. The situation in Gaza is deteriorating beyond his ability to control it. And Gaza represents literally a fraction of what would happen if he started a war against Hezbollah in Lebanon, or a war that involved Syria and Iran, Iran and Syria over the Golan Heights, for instance. Netanyahu is a lot of bluster. Israel is a dangerous nation because it does have, military capability, but they don't have the capability to win. They can start a fight, but they can't finish a fight. And with a state like Israel that's politically unable to handle the kind of casualties that would accrue if a war with Syria or Iran took place, this is just chest dumping.
But Scott, they don't have to win, do they? Because if they were to get into a fight, the United States would be there to help them, possibly Britain too.
Well, really? With what? I mean, what's the great British Army going to deploy? The great British Army can't even get a reinforced battalion off the island over to the Baltics to stand up against the so-called Russian threat. The United States is overextended. Our airplanes barely get off the ground anymore. We spend $700 billion, but we can't deploy large numbers of troops. Where are we going to get the troops to do this? How are we going to sustain the troops in battle? The day of putting 700,000 men on the ground like we did in the Gulf War is long gone. So what is the United States going to do? It's going to start an air-based campaign that it cannot sustain. And once again, Iran wins not by defeating the United States, but by surviving the attack, by waiting the United States out, by forcing the United States to negotiate a ceasefire, by getting the United States to withdraw under terms that are conducive to Iran, not the United States. So again, I'm not worried about this kind of irresponsible war, because any professional, military professional worth his or her salt knows that this is empty talk on the part of the United States and Israel. They don't have the military capability to sustain the kind of conflict necessary to defeat Iran, Syria, or Hezbollah. And the Iranians, the Syrians, and Hezbollah know this.
Now, you're a former Marine, another Marine from a long time ago, a guy called Smedley Butler. He was involved in putting down an attempt to take over the US government by some I think it was George Herbert Walker Bush and some of his friends. It's Prescott Bush was his grandfather back just at the beginning or just before the Second World War. He wrote a book called War is a Racket. What do you make of that as a sort of the idea being that war is there really just for profit? There's a lot of talk about principles, but it's really about grabbing resources and making money.
Well, unfortunately, Smedley Butler was right then, and he's probably correct today. I mean, for the Marines who were my peers, and the group of Marines today that would have been my peers, they are honorable people. I will never denigrate them. These are men and women who are dedicated to the notion of service. Service doing the ugliest thing possible, which is engaged in armed conflict. I believe that there is a necessity for nation states to maintain militaries for the sole purpose of defending their interests from the malign intent of others. The problem isn't the tool. The problem is the person wielding the tool. The military does not make the decision to go to war. The military simply executes the orders given to it by its higher authority. In the United States, this is a civilian government elected by the people, ostensibly. But we have a problem because the people are totally disconnected from this. If you take a look at Congress, they can't even agree to sit down and do what Congress is supposed to do, which is to manage the president's ability to go to war. They're unable or unwilling to talk about amending 2001 provisions that allowed us to fight the so-called war on terror so that it reflects the reality of the present situation. We have presidents and senators and congressmen who, although the vote may be from the people, the votes are paid for by special interests. And so until which time you take money out of the American electoral process, Smedley Butler is correct, because it's special interests who are driving the political power in the United States. And it's the political power, these so-called elected officials, who make the decision on how to wield the military power. So the military does, in fact, become little more than a tool of these special interests carrying out operations that match what's good for their corporate board as opposed to what's good for the American people.
I must also ask you, Scott, about your prosecution. You were prosecuted for online chat of some sort with an underage girl, some kind of sex chat. Can you give us your side of that? Because, I mean, it certainly appears anyway to be a smear on your character.
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is today I stand convicted of a variety of charges. I went on trial, and I was convicted. I'm appealing that conviction. I maintain my innocence. I said I was innocent then. I maintain my innocence today, and no matter what happens, I'll continue to say I didn't do that. I did not have a sexual-related chat with an underage person. That never happened, and it never will happen. That's all I'm going to say about it. I mean, It didn't happen. There was not a sexual chat with an underage person. End of story.
Okay, Scott Ritter, thanks very much.
Okay.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm Andrei Vucic, and I'm a writer, philosopher, investigative journalist, and filmmaker. And I'm talking to you from Beirut, Lebanon.
Andrei, at the moment there's a big tension building as everything seems to be calming down a little bit in Syria. Tension is building up in Donbass and the Sea of Azov, Crimea, the Black Sea, between the Russians and Ukraine. And I suppose in the background, a bit like the proxy war that was going on in Syria, we've got a proxy war going on in Ukraine too, really, ultimately, between NATO and the Russians. What do you make of the last few days, the incident with the ships being boarded by the Russians? Because that does seem to be a provocation by Russia.
Well, absolutely not. I mean, what all the information that I'm getting is that three ships from Ukraine were sailing into the Russian territorial waters with the intelligence officers on board, which is actually proven even and confirmed by the Ukrainians themselves, and they did not communicate correctly with the Russian navigation system. They behaved in a rather aggressive way, and the Russians scrambled their ships, they scrambled jets, and they intercepted these ships. Now, I don't understand really how or what else can this be than a direct provocation of the Ukraine against Russia. Now, of course, the NATO and the European Union, and of course, UK, which is the propaganda kind of propaganda center for the entire NATO and European Union, was immediately attacking Russia. And I think Putin said very correctly that even if the Ukrainians would demand to eat the babies, the NATO and the West would find a way to attack them.
Yeah, but hang on. On the surface of it, this does look like a provocation by the Russians, because it's the Russians that have boarded the Ukrainian Navy ships, these three Navy ships, and imprisoned the sailors, not the other way around.
Tony, reverse the tables. Imagine the Iranian ships, for example, sailing into the British territorial waters.
Up the River Thames, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, what would the UK do? Or what would the United States do if the Cuban flotilla would start, of three ships, would start sailing towards towards Miami? So basically, this is... everything that is happening in regards to Russia, I would always recommend to reverse the tables and imagine what would happen if the same violation would take place in the next to the or on the territory of the UK or the United States. Now, look, there is a very important political, very kind of telling political climate happening in Ukraine. Don't forget that in 3 months, in March, there will be presidential elections. Remember that Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine, has an approval rating of 8%. That according to all the information that I'm getting from Kiev, the capital of Ukraine, there will be problems with heating the flats. There are problems with drinking water, with electricity. The country is falling basically apart. So he has no way of winning presidential elections. The Tymoshenko is leading. There is even some actor, some comedian who didn't declare his candidacy or his attempt to run for president, and he's ahead of Poroshenko right now. So this is very useful for him at this moment. So the martial law, which he declared, he was proposing 2 months, and he got only 1 month from the lawmakers, will mean that no criticism of the government will be allowed. So this will buy him at least 1 month of the time before the elections, and he has an opportunity to show himself as a macho man, you know, standing up to Russia with full support, of course, of totally indoctrinated European Union and NATO.
Well, one of the things I find surprising is that martial law has been declared, even though it's over a naval incident, which is a fair distance away from Ukraine itself in the Sea of Azov, which is controlled by the Russians. I mean, it does seem potentially like this is just an excuse to impose a temporary police state, because certainly what the Russians did in the Sea of Azov and by this bridge, I mean, maybe we should just go over the incident, because much of the coverage in the UK has just been saying, oh, the Russians boarded ships. Actually, what happened was these ships sailed underneath the bridge, which the Russians have built, going into the Sea of Azov.
Yes, got Russia mainland and Crimea, yes.
That's right. And they're supposed, by agreement, they have to ask permission. But these Navy ships sailed under there without permission. So what the Russians then did is they put an oil tanker or a transport ship of some kind across so that the Ukrainian Navy ships couldn't actually then get out. And when they tried to get out, they were then boarded by the Russians.
Yeah, correct. But again, is it unreasonable? Because what we hear now, even from the Ukrainian side, is that these ships were staffed with the intelligence officers from Ukraine, and these people were directing the entire provocation against Russia for whoever they were doing it, either for Poroshenko himself or for NATO, because as we know, the West is doing everything possible to provoke Russia and China lately by all means. So this is again, and you know, the Western public is not questioning the details. There is Googleable. There is a way to find all this information, even about the Ukrainian intelligence officers, even about about their testimonies, and about Russian military is providing was ready to supply Security Council with all the digital data about the tracks of the ships and about the communication between these three Ukrainian ships and the mainland or Russian mainland. So I mean, all this is kind of the facts are not given. It's only again some kind of a hysteria that is being produced in the West and of course in Ukraine. And I think the Ukraine is being sacrificed again, because to antagonize Russia is the worst thing that Ukraine can do. It's a historical part of Soviet Union. It used to be the same country. There are very close ties. And all the West is doing in the last years is provoking this rift between two countries that were coexisting together for many, many years.
Hang on. We hear, though, all the time on the media in the West, we hear in Europe, in the United States, we hear, don't we, that the Crimea area was annexed by Russia. Can you just spell out what actually happened?
Annexed? It's not absolute nonsense again, because Crimea was part of Russia. It was part of Soviet Union. And in drunken stupor, Nikita Khrushchev at some meeting gave it to Ukraine, because it was anyway the same country, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. So it was just a little symbolic act. Then when the confrontation between Russia and Ukraine was heating, and it was clear that if Crimea is going to stay in Ukraine, then NATO is going to use military bases and naval bases there, then what happened, Russia called for referendum, and because there is like close to 90% of Russians, the referendum was won by the Russian people. So it was just logical transfer back to where it was before the drunken stupor of Khrushchev and his absolutely symbolic act of giving it from one part of the country to another.
What about potential for military action? Because quite clearly NATO has been doing manoeuvres inside Ukraine. Although Ukraine is not yet part of NATO, it's almost as if they're trying to fast-track Ukrainian membership.
Exactly. It's NATO is using Ukraine. And it's very sad to watch, because I know Ukraine very well, and I drove through entire Ukraine on several occasions after the conflict began, and I talked to people, and there is a clear provocation coming from Kiev, and there is a difference that you hear from the people on the ground, the villages, or even in the Kharkov, where they try to burn the Russian consulate now. You know, there is enormous amount of Russians. There is interaction. It's basically these two countries are historically and practically inseparable. There are intermarriages. There are Russians in Ukraine. There are Ukrainians in Russia. And people are not anti-Russian, but they are provoked to be anti-Russian. They believe that by following this Western dictate, they will fast track to European Union, and their life is going to miraculously improve. And it's nonsense, because we see what happened to countries like Bulgaria or Romania. They're collapsed, totally collapsed.
So what's going to happen to Poroshenko? Is he going to be jettisoned and another pro-EU, pro-US candidate put in place? Because it doesn't sound to me as if he can win the next presidential election.
they cannot win presidential election with 8% approval rating. It's absolutely unthinkable. But what will happen to Tymoshenko, the candidate which is now leading? I don't know. I don't want to speculate about this. But about Poroshenko, this man is absolutely criminal. This man is a ruthless businessman. And I went to actually to Africa, to West Africa, to Ivory Coast, because, you know, his nickname is the Chocolate King, right? I mean, he built the empire around chocolate industry. And, you know, he gets cocoa from Ivory Coast. And I went to these plantations that he could, it's absolute disgrace. I mean, he's treating people there like in a slavery days. And basically, even in Ivory Coast, I was detained on many occasions. I was not allowed to work. I had to escape from my hotel, literally. It's a big mafia that is running the Ukraine, and it has its paws all over, you know, all the way to West Africa, where people are suffering, actually, because of these plantations. So I don't really know. I mean, Ukraine is at a very complicated situation, because they invested, this government already invested so much into, and the military invested so much to its proximity to NATO and to European Union, that almost it appears like they are committing treason. They are not really representing interests of the people.
Okay, so let's leave Ukraine and go and have a look at Syria, because it does look as if things are calming down there. And we've had an announcement from the Chief of the General Staff in Britain, the commander of the British Armed Forces, who said that actually he believes that the Russians are more dangerous to the British forces and the British interests than ISIS now.
Yeah, look, basically, we all heard the reports that the UK government is paying for all sorts of cells all over Europe to basically discredit Russia, spreading propaganda everywhere in the world. The UK was always behind all the Western propaganda. Don't think so much that US was doing it. I mean, they always have their lieutenants in UK who are very good for 500-600 years of promoting and defending its colonialism.
So what is the point of this Russophobia?
I was just in Syria now, okay? I got out of... I left Syria literally 4 days ago. There is peace. People are celebrating. They are celebrating in muted way, of course, because many people died. So it would be inappropriate to celebrate loudly. But city people, young people go until 2-3 o'clock in the morning smoking shisha, girls and boys. It's, you know, secular country. People are thankful to Russia everywhere. I went to Homs, which was destroyed literally. And even there, people are beginning to rebuild. Of course, Russia is dangerous for Western colonialist interests. Why? Because Russia is actually defending the countries like Syria, which are standing on their own feet and which are not allowing the West to neocolonize them. So, of course, the worst enemies are Russia and China, and of course, countries like Iran and Venezuela, and I don't know, whoever stands on their feet is demonized. You know, and this is... not going to go well in the near future, because Russia and I believe China and Iran, they had enough. This, you know, literally terrorist approach towards the world is not going to go well. And if provoked, both Russia and China are going to defend themselves, because all this propaganda coming from UK or coming from the United States, it's already grotesque. It's not. It's absolutely undemocratic. And you are breaking your own rules of democracy, you know, your own democracy, because Russia and China have different type of democracy. It's built on totally different principles. It's not multi-party Westminster democracy, but you have this kind of what you used to call democracy, and you are breaking your own rules. This is absolutely grotesque what your government is doing right now. And I really think that British people should think very seriously about what is going on.
Is there anything that you think that we can do, though? Because propaganda is actually in a way is self-defeating. You know, I find anyway that people in the UK believe their government less and less. They believe their London-based press less and less all the time.
Yes, totally. But they may not believe your government, and they may not believe the mainstream press. But I just wrote a very big essay, which is public, going viral all over the world. I'm saying, does Western public, doesn't know, or they don't want to know? You see, the point that I make again and again and again is subconsciously, people in the European Union, people in UK, people even in North America, they know what they are doing. They actually understand that it's criminal the way the world is run by the only bunch of the countries. But they are not going to go against this system. I think there is an agreement, unwritten agreement between the public, the corporations, and the government. They have too many privileges in the West. They the privileges are paid by somebody else. People are dying every year. Millions of people in Africa, in Southeast Asia, in all over the Middle East, they're dying so they can have their 6 weeks vacations, they can have their free medical care, free education, and all that. And they will never give up this. So they, and the propagandists in the West know that very well. So what is actually happening is that there is no left anymore, if left is defined as internationalist. You know, they look at Paris. The people are rioting against the fuel prices. Are they really rioting? They want better benefits. Are they really questioning who is paying for those benefits? No. So they pretend that they don't know. They pretend they are ignorant. Because if they accept what the West is doing, then they have to act. They morally, they have to demand the end of these privileges, and they will never do it. They are too selfish, and they are absolutely unwilling to. So the change has to come from outside. And where it's coming from? It's coming from Russia, it's coming from China. Not that these countries are saints, but they are standing by the countries that are actually ready and willing to defend themselves. In case of Syria, this was an absolutely clear case. I describe Aleppo as Stalingrad. It was this is where fascism was stopped, and fascism was a Western invasion using the terrorist organizations that were injected directly from the West or through the regional allies like Saudi Arabia or Qatar. So it's I think it's a very clear scenario, and not to see it is takes great discipline.
What about South America? I know you spent some time there. We're also seeing a swing to, should I say, a lurch to the far right in Brazil and other countries, and also in Ecuador, Venezuela. The revival in the, on the left seems to have ground to a halt.
Yeah, Tony, look, the country that you should watch is Bolivia. Bolivia is a country, absolutely incredible country. I lived in South America, and it was the poorest country in entire South America for many, many decades. Very indigenous, very poor. The white elites were ruling. It was absolutely, the majority was oppressed. With Evo Morales and real socialism, this is the country with the highest growth, development growth in the entire in the entire world. So the life expectancy jumped from 64, I believe, to 72 years. The poverty totally got totally reduced. The minimum wage rose from $40 to $290, and it's religiously observed. And indigenous people have two languages, Quechua and Aymara, which is on the same level as Spanish. So there is total equality. It's an unbelievable miracle what is happening. But why is Bolivia so important? It is because this is what happens to the socialist country, which is left alone. For whichever reason, it escaped direct terrorism from the West. Maybe because it's an Andean country, it's high in the mountains, 4,000 meters, you know, it's a part of it. It's not easy to attack. But all the countries that are now suffering so horrifically, like Venezuela, the problem was injected like into Syria. Venezuela is Latin American Syria. It's all the opposition, and I'm following it from the beginning, and I'm going back and forth to Venezuela for many years. Venezuela is under constant attack of the West and of its own elites. And you know what the Latin American elites are? They're white European people of white European descent. The same people we saw in Chile in 1973, they used the same tactics as pro-Pinochet elites were using. Brazil is a different case. In Brazil, the right-wing media and social media totally overthrew the system. And I was watching it in horror because, you know, I was working all over Brazil for on several occasions. I would go to Manaus in Amazonia. I would go to the jungle. I would ask people, Belém, I would ask people, how is life now? And they would say, it was still under Dilma. They would say, well, life is much better. It's great. We are very happy now. But Dilma has to go. I go like, why? Well, because the mass media and all these social media, they created the atmosphere when if somebody would be doing better, they would think it's because their own personal success. If they, or their own personal, doing. But if something would go wrong, it would be always a fault of the government. And look, it's also these issues of corruption. This is a joke. Look, I can keep repeating it everywhere. Under the right-wing dictatorships, women were raped by German shepherds, by dogs. In Chile, in Argentina, I don't know, people were tortured. People were disappearing. People were thrown alive from helicopters. And this is not an entire industry. Everything was corrupted by the military governments, which were totally pro-West. And then what? Lula da Silva, some company, offers him to renovate his apartment? And he's in jail. And these people are free. People who were killing, people who were raping, people who corrupted billions of dollars. The entire institutionalized corruption goes unpunished. But whenever the left gets to power in Latin America, immediately microscope gets imposed and entire media jumps on them and say, oh, they are not pure. They are not any better than the right. They are much worse than the right. What? To paint the bloody apartment somewhere for the former president is the same as raping and murdering people? It's absolutely grotesque. But it flies. Because if you repeat it 1,000 times, it's what people start to believe. They did the same to Cristina Kirchner in Argentina. And look what Macri is doing. They did the same in Brazil. And you know what will happen now? You will have Indonesia. You will have Jakarta scenario in Brazilian cities. Everything would be eaten. All the public things will be destroyed. Entire nature of Amazonia will end up like Kalimantan, like Borneo in Indonesia. Everything will be ruined. What this PT, the Partido de Trabajadores, the Workers' Party, was building for more than 10 years will be absolutely, absolutely destroyed. And so-called Jakarta scenario, which was already employed in 1973 in Pinochet's Chile, is going now to repeat itself in Brazil.
What about Brexit? I don't know what you make of it as a Russian living in Lebanon now, Andre. Is it significant? There's at the moment a battle going on here in the UK as to whether to accept a deal which means we stay in the customs union for an indefinite period of time. And there are a lot of people are saying, well, actually, that really doesn't mean that we're leaving the European Union. I mean, is Brexit really significant, or is it as the British seem to think at the moment? We get it on the news day after day, and we probably will do until next March when we're supposed to leave, or is it just a drop in the ocean?
Now, Tony, first of all, I don't live only in Lebanon. I live in Lebanon and I live in Asia and also partially in Latin America. But look, to me, to be very honest with you, I follow it on RT, and sometimes I even switch to BBC for strictly entertainment purposes. I think it's I love this shouting at the parliament and knowing that nothing will change. There are two prearranged scenarios. I don't think that knowing who Theresa May is and who her husband is, I think it's very clear where her interests lie. I don't really know. I What I understand is that if there would be a second referendum, the majority of British people would probably vote to stay. But again, is this going to change the world politics or the world kind of mechanics? No, I think it's again the selfish group of people against selfish group of people who absolutely have no interest what is the British role in the global propaganda machinery and also in neo-colonialist. And that's what I care about. I don't really care who is going to win elections in Italy or in Britain. I don't care if Catalonia is going to secede. I don't care whether Britain is going to get out of what interests me is for how long the 90% of the planet has to scream under the Western assaults, and for how long people all over the world will be brainwashed by the British and American educational system, so-called educational system, and mass media.
Okay, what about, you said you just come back from Syria. What are some of your latest projects? I first came across you with a book called Exposing the Lies of the Empire, which it's, I mean, you didn't have to say what the empire was. I suppose we all know it's the Atlanticist empire that you're talking about, essentially, and the global capitalist oligarchy. But what are some of your latest projects, Andre?
Too many, Tony. It's actually crazy. I wish I would have a battalion of people working with me, but I'm alone. I'm writing a book on Obrador's Mexico now. I was filming three weeks, in all over Mexico, where I used to live, and country that I loved very much, and which sank very low, and hopefully now is going to resurrect itself under the socialist or left-wing government. So I'm writing a book on Mexico. I'm looking for editor to edit it because I don't have an editor right now, film editor. So the film project on Mexico, book on Mexico. Then I'm writing book on South. I'm putting together a book on Southeast Asia. It's so many things. Exposing Lies of the Empire was 840 pages book. It's kind of best-selling. It's quite good. But what makes it unique is that I went to all these parts of the world where the empire is trying to divert people from their wishes, where there were coups or where there is propaganda, Western propaganda at place. So I went to all over the world, actually, for several years, and that's a result of Exposing Lies of the Empire. But the book projects, it's Mexico. It's also the book on which I write right now with American professor and very famous philosopher, 93 years old, Whiteheadian, John Cobb, who influenced the government of China to go ecological. So it is about China and ecological civilization, and we are very much close to publishing this book, probably at the end of December. There is a book on Middle East. There is just an enormous amount of work that I'm producing. Just now I gave about four interviews for Italians, for you, for Italian magazine, for soon for Indian magazine, Countercurrents. So it's really basically a battle to how to fit to 24 hours. The film I want to make about Syria and Afghanistan, comparing Kabul and Damascus, because, you know, I work a lot in Afghanistan, and it's absolutely destroyed, devastated country. And then I want to compare visually the Afghanistan to which is still under American and British NATO occupation, and Syria, which won the war almost completely. So that's another film project, and I'm, of course, the biggest project, the longest project I'm involved with now. I'm documenting as a writer and as a filmmaker the total devastation of the third biggest island on Earth, which is Borneo, known as Kalimantan in Indonesia, where they absolutely destroyed the environment. The the Indonesian elites and Western mining and logging companies is just absolute disaster that is not being discussed anywhere in the West. Because there is nothing left. Basically, the third biggest island on Earth, so big that you have to fly a jet from one side to another for 2.5 hours. Now, this island is the rivers are poisoned with mercury. The French are digging uranium there secretly. The whole island is covered by palm oil plantations and the open pit mines are just everywhere, and they are leveling hills, even mountains, for mining purposes, and all is protected by like private armies and private interests. And so I'm really literally risking my life, and I'm filming there periodically, and of course with no support, because nobody wants to hear about this stuff.
I mean, are you seriously saying that even networks like Telesur, Russia Today, Al Jazeera aren't interested in these stories?
I really, Tony, I have one problem in life, a really serious problem. I am the worst business person on earth. I don't know how to get funding. I don't know how to write proposals. To me, it's easier to make a film than to write a proposal. I'm just so absolutely useless when it comes to, I produce one book, one big philosophical and journalistic essays from all over the world. I go to war zones. But I don't know how to write proposal. I can give you 20 pages report from Syria, which I'm doing right now. But to write 2 pages of proposal, I just don't know how. So it's probably my mistake. But I usually work like this. I just write the book and it sells.
Somehow. Well, look, for our listeners, what's the best place to find you online, Andre?
Oh yeah, you can find me online actually. You can go to my blog, my website. You can go to, again, I don't even know my own. Yeah, it's my name. It's Andre Vlček, all in one, .weebly.com. So it's AndreVlček.weebly.com. Or if you want to get my latest work, you can just go to my Twitter, because I'm slamming all the translations of my articles and my articles, reports, books there. And my Twitter handle is @AndreVlček. Again, my first and second name all in one. So you can find me there. And there is also my website there. So if you are interested, come and let's have a journey together. But it's a crazy, I warn you, it's a crazy ride. I mean, I'm everywhere. I don't sleep anymore. I don't know what it is to rest, but it's great fun.
Andre Vlček, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, Tony, thank you so much.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. You can subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Scott Ritter, former United States Marine Corps Colonel and UN Iraq Weapons Inspector. Also, filmmaker, poet, journalist and philosopher Andre Vlček. His name is spelt V-L-T-C-H-E-K. Andre Vlček. Thanks also to studio engineers Dave Bazanko and Joss Chivers. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. Volunteer with us if you like, or for hundreds of opportunities across Britain via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my 2-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday, midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
balalıktan osken evge koz yaşım buştu. Ben bu yerde yaşalmadım, yaşlılığıma toy almadım, vatanıma hasret oldum ey güzel kırık. Ben bu yerde yaşalmadım, yaşlılığıma toy almadım, vatanıma hasret. Toy almadım vatanıma, hasret oldum.